He hasn't even turned 30, but composer Nico Muhly has had a career that's been as productive as it is hard to define. Or as the Times of London put it, to call his career eclectic does not even begin to describe it. There's his score for the Academy Award-nominated film The Reader. Nico Muhly was also an assistant to Philip Glass. The Juilliard-trained musician also released a number of albums, including 2009's Mother Tongue. He collaborated with the group Grizzly Bear and Bjork. He's got an opera going for the Met, and he wrote this piece, Drones and Piano, for the Gilmore Keyboard Festival. Drones and Piano will receive its Boston premiere tonight. Nico wrote the piece for New England Conservatory piano chair Bruce Brubaker, who performs it here and will tonight. And Nico Muhly joins us from the Argo Network studios in New York. Nico, let's start there. When you get a commission like that, what is your job as a composer?
Well, I think you want to write something that highlights... You know, what you can do is you can make something that highlights the technical proficiency of the pianist. That's one option. Mm-hmm. I've known Bruce for about 12 years. I mean, I met Bruce my freshman year at Juilliard when he used to teach there. And I know that he's someone who is, I think, more interested in the life of the mind than in the life of the fingers. And I wanted to write for him a piece that requires a bit more thought and that has a lot of things sort of left open to do with how fast you play it and the distance between phrases and... So I wanted to write something that required constant reinvention rather than there being this sort of mountain of notes that you climb and then you get to stick a flag at the top of it.
Nico, where did this all start for you? I already know, and I want to hear about the moment where you were singing in a chorus, I believe in Providence, Rhode Island, and heard
in Providence,
music.
Yeah. You know, the business of being in the choir is funny because you're making music as part of a team, in a sense, and singing as much music as you have to in a choir, at a certain point you get into this sort of trance-like state where you've just learned so much. And I think something happened in my head where we were singing this bird motet, and I just thought, this is life-changing and you know, full-body shivers. And I thought I would sort of attempt to devote my life at recreating that experience.
This was the bird Christmas motet, Sanax Purum Portabat?
Sanax Purum Portabat, yeah.
From having a moment singing in a choir in Providence, the path that you've traveled is at once all over the place, you know, working with Bjork and opera companies and Philip Glass, but it's also seems deliberate. So what did you decide about how you were going to take up music?
You know, it's interesting you should say because I think deliberate is almost the opposite of what it's been.
Yeah.
The way I've gotten away with doing so many different things is by not making too many plans. I mean, there's really no itinerary. Everything I've done has been a natural extension of sort of wanting to work with friends and wanting to surround myself with people whose music or music making I really like.
Well, and you've brought your love of choral music along the way. This is Kyrie from your 2005 work, Bright Mass with Canons. Here it's performed by the Los Angeles Master Chorale. Let's listen. Just beautiful. I'm wondering, you know, what are the influences for someone, you know, who's as young as you are and avant-garde? I mean, are there contemporaries that are influencing you as well?
I think enormously. I mean, I listen voraciously. I mean, that's another sort of, maybe that's another thing that I do deliberately is I listen to as much music as I possibly can. It's not about sort of going from point A to point B inside the work of Beethoven. It's more like, okay, so you'd listen to this Beethoven and then you listen to, you know, 3 hours of Tracy Chapman and then you listen to some crazy CD that someone handed you in the street and then you listen. I mean, it's sort of about trying to survey the whole thing,
yeah.
Which of course is impossible, but if you try really hard, you can get pretty close.
Well, you mentioned, you know, people just might come up to you on the street and say, listen to this. And I'm thinking of pieces like Mother Tongue, the words are more spoken here, and there's an electronic sound. And do we understand, in at least one report, some found sound?
In the album Mother Tongue, there's a lot of found sound. There's a lot of sound that heavily amplified things that you wouldn't necessarily hear. Like, for instance, the sound of putting on a slipper that you can then sort of put a microphone as close to that as you can.
Where is that?
In the middle of the only tune. There's just this sort of rhythmic kind of scraping in the background, sort of noise. And it's somewhere in there. I mean, one of the great things about found sound, too, is if you think about them as instruments and then you use them as such, it stops becoming so special and starts becoming just another kind of vocabulary, another. So you do it and then you sort of forget where they went, and it's fun. Oh, the wind and the rain.
And then there's the other aspect of your work. New York Magazine calls you Nico, the helper to famous singers, as one of your many categories.
How very kind of them.
pick one musical example where we might hear Nico in other musicians, or maybe it's like the slipper.
No. I mean, arranging is a complicated business. I mean, but if you listen to I did this album with an Icelandic singer called Jónsi this last year, and his album is called Go. Essentially, you know, he started with these, with just him and a guitar, and then I overlaid this enormous meshwork of instruments and, you know, all of which are acoustic and recorded very sort of, you know, naturally and honestly. Glow. You know, arranging is funny because you don't want to. It's not about you at a certain point. It's rather like dressing someone for something where you don't want to. You know, the point isn't the dress. The point is that the person wearing the dress looked great, right? That's the fun. And the arranger needs to be sort of like the couturier in that sense, where you make the person look amazing and not the garment.
What about soundtracks? This is where you have a filmmaker who has a real vision of their own.
It's a little bit of both in that sense. I mean, soundtracks also, different kinds of movies require the help of music in different ways. I mean, the one that you played before, The Reader, the score was entrusted with a kind of complicated task where the score has to kind of throw the viewers off the scent of the sort of, there's a twist in the movie. So the score is allowed to know the secret, but the score can't be broadcasting, I have a secret and I'm telling what it is.
Oh, it can't be going dun, 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 dun.
Right, exactly.
What do you think about, you know, everybody bemoans young people moving away from classical music, moving away from opera. What are your thoughts?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen it. I mean, I'm lucky because I hang out with a lot of young people who are more devoted to classical music than you can ever imagine anyone being devoted to anything. So I may be speaking from a place of unspeakable privilege, but I'm not really into the conversation of sort of generations turning away from classical music, just because in my experience it's just not true and I can't speak outside of my own experience.
Well, and if it is at all true, it sounds like you'd be the guy to pull him back in. That's Nico Muhly. A multidimensional, including classical, composer. Nico, thanks so much, and best to you.
Thanks very much.